When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the New Books Network. My name's Claire Clark. I'm the host of New Books in Medicine. And today we're talking to Travis Reeder, who is a faculty member at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, where he directs the Master of Bioethics degree program. He holds secondary appointments in the Department of Philosophy and Health Policy and Management, as well as the Center for Public Health Advocacy. And he's the author of Catastrophe Ethics, How to Choose Well in a World of Tough Choices, which is just out now from Penguin Random House. Travis, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what brought you to this research.
Yeah, I mean, so this question that I'm investigating in catastrophe ethics, which, you know, we'll get into, but the sort of summary level is, how do you live a morally decent life in this very complex world where the problems we face are so massive and structural that our individual actions can't seem to make a meaningful difference, certainly can't solve them. So that question has been eating at me since pretty early in my PhD days. So I did my PhD at Georgetown University, and I'd say probably in my second or third year of my PhD, I was looking for important moral issues, and I started thinking about climate change. And as I realized just how bad things were, and I realized that most people were talking about just how bad things were, I became really obsessed with the ethics and policy implications of climate change. So the short version of this story is a couple of my friends and I, Colin Hickey and Jake Girl, we started working on the policy side together. We didn't have a lot of education in policy, and so we were trying to bring ourselves up to speed. And what the group of us came to was a realization that there are all of these massive contributors to climate change, and people were talking about some but not others. And one that people were not talking about, and fairly intentionally not talking about, was procreation and population. So that, you know, things like climate change sustainability problems are a problem of how many people there are and how much each of those persons consume. And we talk about the consumption side, but not the population side a lot. So we found that very striking as ethicists, and we thought about it from a sort of global perspective and a sort of policy perspective together a lot. But then what happened for me is that I'm, you know, in my late 20s, early 30s, I've been married for a while. I'm thinking about the question of whether my partner and I should have kids, you know, whether we want to bring somebody into this world. And so I get interested in the sort of individual ethics question of procreative ethics. And so at the bottom of this, I found myself wrestling with this issue of, it feels like there is a lot of people doing a lot of consumption on the planet. It also feels like that means that there is a moral issue around the question of whether I should add somebody to that problem. But it's also the case that my one child is not going to make the problem meaningfully worse. And I just didn't know what to do with that. So that was a long answer to your simple question. But basically, I have been wrestling with this idea that we make very, very tiny contributions to big structural problems since about the year 2012 or so. And I probably have 20 academic publications that in some way touch on this problem, because it's just been living with me and living rent-free in my head for all this time. So the book is finally my sort of most sustained attempt to address that question.
Well, I don't want to get ahead of us here, but did you have kids? What did you do?
I did, yeah. So, you know, this was probably the first series of publications that, you know, tried to tackle this problem at all was when my partner and I were deciding that we were in fact going to have a child. And my very first academic publication was on this challenge that some philosophers have put forward, that we actually have an obligation to adopt rather than to have a child. And so I was sort of trying to rebut that objection as I was thinking about having my own child, but I kept coming back to this environmental cost of having a child. And so the sort of uncomfortable compromise that we came to in our own family is that we thought having a child was justifiable, even in this world with so much consumption going on. But that our child was going to be expensive. She's being born in America. She's being born into a family that is, by global standards, wealthy and using more than, you know, our fair share of resources. And so we decided we probably couldn't justify having more than one. But as you said, that is sort of jumping ahead in the moral reasoning.
Yes, yes. Well, I think it's important that you're a philosopher. I take it that this book is written for a more general audience, but it does what philosophers do, which is to take a problem and really break the thing down into its component parts, and then, you know, follow the logical train of thought posed by it. And you, the center of catastrophe ethics is something that you call the puzzle. And you say that the problem of climate change is what you call the paradigm example of the puzzle. And so if you could just, you know, in the way that you do for non-philosophers, break down what is this puzzle at the center of the book.
Yeah, so you're exactly right that this book is meant for everyone. And so that's why I published it with Penguin Random House rather than, say, you know, Oxford or Princeton, some academic press. I wanted to have this conversation with everyone. And the reason that I did is because I've had this conversation with friends and family and, you know, just people I meet at parties. And it really is immediately gripping for so many people when I present the puzzle. Like, yes, I struggle with this in my life. So here's the way I describe the puzzle. The puzzle is the fact that in an era with problems like climate change, I feel an individual moral responsibility to act in response. So the world is on fire and the news is constantly bad. And the root cause of all of that is emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. Now, because what we as individuals do is we emit, right? We drive and we eat and we consume and we take vacations and we fly. We are contributing to this problem. And so I think a lot of morally serious people who care about the world and care about our place in it, they see our connection to the problem and they feel a moral responsibility. They feel a moral responsibility to pull back, to withdraw from contributing to and participating in that problem. But it gets really frustrating because the problem is so grand in scale and so incredibly complex that we're talking about dangerous climate change occurring when trillions of metric tons of greenhouse gases are emitted into the atmosphere. And they're sucked up into this massively complex carbon cycle that you can't even begin to fathom, which by itself doesn't do harm, but then leads to these terrible weather patterns that are harmful for beings like us who evolved to survive in this niche. And what that means is that my tiny little contribution, even the big ones by my standards, taking a transatlantic flight causes a ton of CO2 emissions. That's less than a trillionth of the problem. This is infinitesimal. It doesn't make a meaningful difference. So the puzzle is the felt sense that I have a moral responsibility to respond to the catastrophe and the reality that I can't do anything meaningful in response.
So you do, the book does answer the puzzle, but before you answer it, you tell us some ways not to answer it, what you call traps. So what are some of the common traps that might befall us in trying to answer this puzzle? What are the traps?
Yeah, so this came about from my informal sociological experiments of talking to people who will talk to me about this. And, I sort of kept a tabulation of the way people tried to escape careful moral reasoning. And so those are the things that I call the traps. And so some folks, when I pose this sort of problem or any really devastating problem that would make us uncomfortable about our place, our moral place in the world, the retreat is to religion. And in the book, I say, well, look, you know, I'm not picking a fight with religion. I'm not going to try to argue that there is no God or that God looks a certain way. But the retreat is to say that religion solves the ethics problem for us. And the way in which religion does that is if you believe in a sort of divine command view. So God tells us what to do. God or gods lay down the rules for morality, and that our only real responsibility is to just do what the scripture says or the dictates of some god say. And so I think that's a trap, because it would be really nice if it were true. It'd give us clear answers. But then I go through this sort of philosophical story about how it doesn't actually satisfy the problem very well. And the quick version of my argument is one that I steal from Plato, which was brought up in the dialogue Euthyphro, where Euthyphro is coming up against Socrates. And Socrates asks Euthyphro what the pious is, which we can just say, what is the good or what is the just? And Euthyphro says, well, the pious is what is loved by the gods. And Socrates says, well, is the pious pious because it's being loved by the gods, or is it being loved by the gods because it's pious? And this becomes known as Euthyphro's dilemma. And it's launched, you know, 2000 years of investigation. But what I take the upshot of this to be is that when you say that God tells us the right moral action, we have to decide whether God is commanding the action because it's the right thing to do, or whether it's the right thing to do because God commands it. And the latter, that it's the right thing to do because God commands it, I think is unacceptable, because it means that God's commands are arbitrary, that there is no reason to choose one thing or over another. And so God could just as easily have commanded murder and torture as, you know, love thy neighbor. And so that leaves us with the other horn of the dilemma, which is that God commands things because they are right. And that seems true. It seems like if you believe in God, then what you should believe is that God is good, which means that God is responding appropriately to value. But that means that we actually don't need a God story to tell us what the right thing to do is, because God is just responding to the value in the world. And that's what we should be doing too. So that's the basic view, that divine command sort of morality is a trap, because it promises this sort of seductive, easy answer. But we really still have to do the work. We have to figure out like why God is responding to value in this way. So that's trap number one. Mm-hmm. Second one's faster. Sorry, do you want to go get in there?
No. Tell us the second one, please.
The second one is one that's very popular with my students today. This is a sort of younger generation move, especially on the sort of cosmopolitan East Coast here, which is relativism. Relativism is also a seductive, easy solution to all moral questions, because you sort of throw up your hands and say, well, you know, that's your opinion, you know, that we should do things that way. Or, well, you know, I think we should reduce our emissions, but like, who am I to say that to someone else who's living differently? And so my argument against relativism is a little quick and a little flip. But I also think, like most philosophers, that it's pretty devastating, which is most of us, in fact, believe that there are moral facts. And we believe that there are moral facts because we think it's objectively true that it's wrong to light babies on fire for fun. and like, you know, if I can get you there, that it's wrong to light babies on fire for fun. And, you know, some of my students, they really do. They really want to like squirm and start saying, well, maybe for some cultures or something. I'm like, come on, really? You think that in some culture, just because they like this as entertainment, it's morally permissible to light babies on fire for fun? And if you can't bring yourself to say yes, then we found a moral fact. There's something that's universally true. And now the job of ethics is to just try to figure out how many of these moral facts there are and sort of how to get close to them. And that example sounds really cartoonish, but of course there are lots of really terrible real world examples like slavery. And so one of the things that I think shows most clearly that there are moral facts is that the United States became a morally better society when it outlawed slavery. And you can only say that if there is an external standard against which cultures and groups and beliefs are evaluated. And so slavery is wrong, was wrong, even in the slaveholding South prior to the Civil War. And that's why the United States became a morally better society when it outlawed slavery. So that's my response to relativism.
So there's religious dogmatism, there's moral relativism, and those are common traps. But then you go on to say that traditional moral philosophy is also inadequate for answering the puzzle. And can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so this is the one that's going to get me in most trouble with my colleagues. because, you know, moral philosophers are very often moral philosophers because they want to figure out the truth. They want to figure out, like, what's the one true theory that will rule us all. And so I spend a while thinking about what it would mean if that were actually the case, right? That the way to do practical ethics in the world depended on finding the correct moral philosophy. That would mean several things. One of the things it would mean is that philosophers are the only experts that are qualified to actually do ethics, but they aren't even qualified in virtue of being expert philosophers, because the job is to find the one true moral philosophy and apply it. And philosophers have spent thousands of years arguing about this, and we are no closer to consensus. In fact, we employ philosophers to come up with ever more variants of philosophy to disagree with, you know, ever more variants of ethics and ethical theory. So my general sort of view here is that moral philosophers are tempted by moral philosophies in the same sort of way that many religious folks are tempted by a divine command theory, that it might be complicated to work out what God's dictates are, and it might be complicated to work out which moral theory is true. But what you really want in both cases is to do that work up front and then say, oh, thank goodness we got the hard work done. Now it's just about going around and applying facts to my moral theory. And it's divisive in the same sort of way. You know, if you come from a particular sect of a particular religion and say, I figured out the truth and I can go around and apply it, well, you've limited your audience. You know, very few people are going to disagree with you. Very few people are going to agree with you because you're starting with a set of assumptions that are incredibly divisive. And I think the same thing is true about moral philosophies. So what we really need is we need a sort of methodology for using all of the sorts of tools that people routinely rely on, and not assuming that any, you know, single view is going to be straightforwardly applicable. So this is maybe some of the most opinionated part of the book, in fact, because I'm saying, look, we need to take seriously all of the great sort of contributions to moral reasoning in history, and most people do in their lives, right? So moral philosophers might say, I'm a consequentialist, I'm a utilitarian. So I actually think that, you know, the rule is bring about the most happiness for the most people all the time in all your actions. But no, like, normal non-philosopher humans who have never thought about it actually follows that, because there are these other philosophers, deontologists or anti-utilitarians, who say, no, because people have individual rights, and our duty is to respect those rights and to respect the inherent dignity in people. And that means you can't always promote the most happiness, because promoting the most happiness would run roughshod over rights sometimes. And I think that's how, like, actual people reason, is that we think that people have rights, we have a duty to respect individuals' dignity, and we should promote happiness. And, like, the challenge of ethics is figuring out how to do those things at the same time, not deciding that one of them is the one true theory to rule them all, and then applying it and running roughshod over our other intuitions. So I make everybody mad, and I just say, we need to take seriously all of the sort of deep core human intuitions about morality. And the work of ethics is arguing carefully from shared sets of commitments, and taking seriously others' objections to any view that we put forward. Just like down in the mud. This is the stuff that practicing bioethicists do, practicing policy folks do.
So you put forward a framework for answering the puzzle that you call catastrophe ethics, or sometimes participatory ethics. And so I wonder if you could kind of explain and break that framework down for our listeners.
Yes, I will try. So the first move that I make in this participatory mode is to say, the philosophical literature that has tried to solve the puzzle, they have been challenged for a particular reason. So the reason they have been challenged is you have philosophers who have this intuition that I have a duty not to, say, take a joyride in my Hummer, my big SUV, my fuel inefficient vehicle. So I have a duty because that is a luxury contribution of greenhouse gases. It contributes to climate change, which causes harm, so I shouldn't do it. And then the puzzle is, well, where do you get that duty if your individual contribution is so small that it doesn't actually meaningfully harm anyone or contribute to harm or worsen any harm? And so what I do is I say, look, that objection is actually right. You don't have a duty. And it's a good thing you don't have a duty, because we would be constantly frozen. We would be paralyzed by all of the obligations we have not to participate in all sorts of harms and injustices. Because climate change isn't the only problem that has this structure. Think about consumption. If you eat meat or any animal products, you're participating in this massive systematic torture and killing of beings with welfare, animals. If you consume anything, if you purchase anything, you are participating in supply chains that you don't know about, and a whole bunch of them have terrible labor practices. You know, you and I are talking on electronics right now. Those electronics are powered by lithium-ion batteries. Lithium-ion batteries require cobalt, and cobalt is mined disproportionately in the Republic of Congo under conditions that have been called modern day slavery, right? So most of us, our lives are powered. This is language from Siddharth Kara. Our lives are powered by the blood of the Congo, sometimes by kids who are working in these mines. And so if you take this idea seriously, that you have an obligation not to contribute to massive structural harms and injustices, you are obligated not to do many, many things, maybe most things that we do in our lives. Okay, so if you give up an obligation, what does that mean? Does it mean that nothing matters? Should we just embrace nihilism? I say no. I say the answer here is to figure out how to do careful moral reasoning if you reject a purity standard. So yes, you can't fully withdraw from life, so purity ethic fails, but also that doesn't imply nihilism. Just because a purity ethic fails doesn't mean that nothing matters. How does that work? Well, I think it's because we might not have duties not to do these things, but we do have reasons not to do them, right? So you go back to the joy guzzling case. This is from a philosopher, Walter Sennett Armstrong. You know, should you drive around in your Hummer just for fun? I think you've got really good reasons not to drive around in your Hummer just for fun, right? Because it's contributing to this massive problem. It's not a duty, and so we probably shouldn't hold you accountable for it. Moral society shouldn't stand up and demand that you not do this, in the same way that we shouldn't demand that everybody get rid of their computers and phones, etc. But it's something you should consider as you organize your life. So the project of catastrophe ethics, or what I sometimes call participatory ethics, is designing a way of thinking, a framework for asking the question, how should I structure my life such that I can try to respond to these reasons in a justifiable way?
And you say climate change is sort of the paradigm example of a puzzle for which catastrophe ethics or participatory ethics would be useful. But you go on to say in the conclusion that it also can apply to all of these other seemingly overwhelming social problems of the you know, early 21st century. Your first book was about opioids. And so I wonder if you could just to apply participatory ethics to another problem, How would it apply to the overdose epidemic?
Yeah, so this is one of the things ultimately led to me writing this book, is that I was doing book talks and traveling around and giving conference presentations on the opioid epidemic. I still had this project in the back of my head from all those, you know, papers that I wrote, I told you, going back to graduate school. And so one of the things that would happen is I'd go around and I would talk to parents of people who died from drug overdose, you know, siblings, someone who's struggling with addiction. And I would get this question over and over again in, you know, book talks and like small sort of book club presentations where the stakes felt really high. This was really sort of an intimate question. Somebody would say, how do I make this better? You know, I'm just one person. The drug overdose crisis is killing 100,000 people a year. Nobody should ever have to feel the way I feel right now. How do I help fix this? And it really tore me up, because a lot of times the people asking me, I didn't have an answer for, you know. So if I go to a conference and talk to doctors, I can say things because doctors have training where I can say, look, go get your waiver for buprenorphine, which isn't required anymore. But for many years when I was giving talks, you had to get a waiver to prescribe this addiction medication. So go take the training, get a waiver for buprenorphine, and start offering this as part of your practice. And so I could say to them, you know, in your practice, here's a way that you can improve lives for people with addiction. But a lot of folks who came up to me and asked, I didn't have anything to say. And so I started developing a sort of series of responses in which I asked them, you know, what are your interests? What do you do for a living? What do you do with your time? What are your skills? What are your hobbies? What are your passions? And I would use this to get information about them and try to figure out, like, what's the piece that you could play in this big puzzle that together we have to put together. And so sometimes a parent, for instance, you can tell these are the ones that live in my head, right? Because I keep bringing them up. But, you know, a parent of someone that they lost overdose would say, well, I'm willing to tell my story. It's hard and I cry every time, but if it will help another parent not experience this, I'll tell my story. And so, you know, I talk to them about maybe how they can do this in a sort of more public way and think of this as a social contribution to this big society-wide project of solving the overdose crisis. And some people don't want to talk. They don't want to share, but they have money. And so they're like, you know, where can I give? And so I teach them about harm reduction coalitions and say, you know, maybe if we had more things like safe consumption sites or needle exchanges or whatever, you know, maybe this wouldn't have happened. And so we can try to fix that by making our little contribution here. And so I started developing this sort of triaging for other people. And that actually ended up becoming one of the sort of framework tools that I provide in the book, where I ask people about climate change or about anything, like, think about the ways in which you are placed personally, subjectively, such that you can make some kind of contribution to the solution. And this includes the purity stuff, right? So in the climate change case, you can withdraw from participating, you can cut down your carbon footprint. But importantly, that's not the only thing you can do in the climate case, because you can also do those social, and, you know, I talked about like giving to nonprofit organizations in the harm reduction case. So the charitable giving component, like, those exist in the climate cases too. And so I build this sort of 3x3 matrix in the book where I invite people to start developing heuristics for themselves. Like, how can I live in the face of this particular problem? Pick the drug overdose crisis, or pick climate change, or pick animal welfare issues, and start to develop heuristics for yourself. And some of them will be sort of purity focused. You can get less involved in the harm yourself. And some of them will be more social. You can start talking about it and raising awareness and being part of this sort of community. And then some of it is like really trying to contribute to the structural changes. And this is like voting and lobbying and potentially even, you know, running for office or, you know, working for someone in phone banking. And so that sort of different way of breaking things up is part of what I invite people to do, but for all of the problem sets. So the drug overdose crisis, in my experience talking to these folks really helped bring to mind the solution tool that I want to offer folks for all of the problems.
So at the end of the day, it really is a very practical book, even though you're a philosopher and you get into logic and all of these things.
I mean, that is the goal. You know, I wrote the book because I struggle with this. My friends struggle with this. My family struggles with this. You know, as I said, when I present the puzzle, it's not very often that I present it to someone and they're just left cold with it. You know, a lot of folks say, like, yes, I feel guilty for the meat that I eat, or yes, I feel guilty for my big carbon footprint because I fly to all these conferences as an academic. And even the folks who don't feel guilty, they sort of very intentionally don't feel guilty. They've embraced the nihilist side and say, look, what I do doesn't matter. Stop trying to make me feel guilty. This is a problem caused by 100 companies who are, you know, responsible for some huge percentage of all emissions. Don't blame me. But like, that's a real response, right? To come up with that on the spot, you've wrestled with this. So yes, I want it to be practical. And the tools that I offer at the end aren't a capital T, the answer. Instead, it is, there is no the answer. There are lots of different ways that people can live justifiable lives. And I want to help you think through your version of that.
Well, thank you. That brings us to our traditional final question here on the New Books Network. And that is, you've been wrestling with this book since your doctoral dissertation, and now it's out there in the world. What's next? What are you working on next?
This is such a hard question for, you know, writers, because we want to write all the things. I will be continuing to work on this project because the book is a bit of a framework. And, you know, in my mind, it opened up a series of questions that all require more work. And so, yes, I provide these tools for the reader, and I hope that it gives them some sense of control and empowerment. What I really talk about at the end is, I hope it gives them a sense of agency, like they can do some meaning making in their life by trying to develop this justifiable life. But the developing of that justifiable life is still a ton of work in itself. And so there are particular problems within that I want to keep working on. And so one that I have written a little bit about, but I would like to spend a lot more time on in the coming years, is how do we triage, right? So how do we triage between problems? And this is a problem because catastrophe ethics is about all of these major catastrophes in our lives, right? And so we have climate change, and we have these consumer supply chains that are devastating, and we have all sorts of other environmental degradation problems, but we also have animal agriculture. And then you get to the public health stuff, you know, so when I say, look, this sort of reasoning even applies to the opioid crisis, well, then it certainly applies to things like structural racism, it applies to infectious disease outbreaks, like, the world is full of so much massive harm and injustice that we could play a role in helping to solve, or that we do play a role in contributing to, that one of the things that I want to spend more time thinking about is, are there things that really everyone should be addressing? And in the book, I nod to the idea that I think climate change should sort of be on everyone's list. I think that for especially white folks, structural racism should be on their list, because we are participants in it in the same way that we are participants in climate change, because we benefit from the way people respond to our presentation. And so I give the first sort of hints at triaging, but man, there's a lot more work to do. So I'd like to spend some time thinking about, like, how do we triage in an era of catastrophe? And very unrelated. Well, I guess none of this is wholly unrelated, but distant from that, you know, because I have these sort of multiple projects you alluded to. My last book was on opioids and pain and the opioid crisis. So my opioid work has really gotten into harm reduction in recent years. And so I have begun thinking about the role of safe supply, the ethics of safe supply, which is the idea that when the drug supply is so toxic as it is in North America today. That is part of the reason that so many people are dying from drug overdose, is the unpredictability and toxicity of the drug supply. So a harm reduction solution to that is to give people who are going to use drugs free pharmaceutical grade pure drugs. So if somebody has an addiction to heroin, but they're getting, you know, dirty heroin on the street laced with fentanyl and xylazine and all this other stuff, you can help reduce the harm of their addiction by giving them free pharmaceutical grade heroin. And as you might imagine, that is an idea that is not super popular with lots of people, but the public health argument for it is pretty strong. So I have begun to investigate the ethics of how the radical edge of harm reduction should or shouldn't become part of our societal lives.
Well, those are all wonderful threads to be following from this book. And I look forward to continuing to follow your work as it develops. And so this has been Travis Ryder talking about his new book, Catastrophe Ethics. Thank you so much, Travis, for coming to talk to us on the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.